Hello, my name is Colm O'Regan, and welcome to The World Etc., a new monthly podcast in association with Trocara, looking at topical issues facing people around the world. With International Women's Day coming up soon, we decided to focus our very first episode on the subject of women in leadership, and I'm joined by three very special guests. Jennifer Bray is a political reporter with the Irish Times. Lindsay Davey is a Dublin footballer, as she has three All-Irelands and four All-Stars, and she's also a former Dublin captain. And Caoimhe de Barra is CEO of Trocara. We're going to be looking at women pushing the boundaries in their particular fields. And to start with, Lindsay, you've obviously experienced great success on the GAA pitch, but also in your job, you're in an area that is traditionally dominated by men. You're a firefighter. What is it like being one of the very few women in a firefighting crew?
I love it. Like, it's definitely been my dream job since I was a kid, and to finally kind of get into the role a couple of years ago, you know, I've been very lucky to be able to do that. But like I said, it is definitely a kind of male dominant job, but I think it's a job where it definitely would be lovely to see kind of more women getting involved, and there's no reason why they can't.
Do the public react differently when a woman firefighter turns up?
Not that I'm aware of, but I suppose if you're going to an incident, you're kind of just focused on the job in hand. And if it's the likes of a car crash or something that you're going to, you're solely focused on what you have to do, and you're not really focusing on what's around you other than just making sure the people in the car get out safely, and you're kind of just doing your job well.
And your other area of expertise is football, and the women's football, I mean, it's kind of a source of pride for Ireland in many ways. One of the biggest, the All-Ireland final is one of the biggest attendances for any women's event around Europe, I think, isn't it? It's up over 50,000.
Yeah, like, it's definitely gone from strength to strength. And I think that's kind of down to the promotion of Lidl coming on board. During the past two All-Ireland finals, we had attendance of 45,000 and 50,000 people attending. And when you're on the pitch and you're seeing the likes of the upper tiers now starting to be filled in Croke Park, it's just unbelievable from where it started to where we're going. And it's a really exciting time to be a part of it.
There are lots of girls getting involved at primary level, but is it the case that the numbers of girls drop off as teenage approaches?
Yeah, like, Lidl did research 2 years ago to show that there is a high dropout when kind of female in their teenagers. But I suppose with us now, even with Dublin, I've seen such a change in how the success that we have done with getting to the All-Ireland finals the past couple of years, and even from a club perspective, the impact that has had. You know, when I first started with Scaries, I used to play with the boys because we didn't have an underage girls team, whereas now the female section in the club is nearly bigger than the lads, and it's gone from strength to strength. And I suppose even when we go around to schools with the trophy and all after the final, just there's so many young girls so excited kind of seeing us, and they're like, they want to be a part of that when they grow older. So the fact that you can see the impact that you're having is fantastic, and hopefully we can work towards stopping that dropout rate.
And is some of that, you know, who people's role models are at the age of 12 or 13, before you'd ask people, what do they want to be? They want to be a sports person, they want to be a scientist, whereas now people want to be a celebrity. Is there a sense that you and others have to be leaders to them?
Yeah, well, I suppose even with my club, I've seen with our club, like, say last year's All-Ireland final, we had four or five busloads of girls coming to the final. And I suppose when you're being a role model for them and you see the positive things that you're doing on a pitch and that they want to be like that, I think it's fantastic getting young women to be, say, involved in sport. Because for me, like, my life wouldn't be the way it is now as a result of sport. You know, it's benefited my life in so many different ways, and I think younger girls are kind of seeing that as well in the likes of Scaries. So the fact that they have someone to aspire to, and there's plenty of women in sport in Ireland that are great role models, that I think there's more and more every day, and I think it's fantastic for young girls to be able to look up to that.
Jennifer, you work in the Dáil as a political correspondent. Is there still a gender imbalance in terms of women and men TDs? Would you call it a boys' club now?
No, I don't think so. I think we're making slow and gradual change away from that perception of the Dáil being a boys' club. I think if you look in the last election, we've seen some really impressive women elected. I'm talking specifically maybe about people like Kate O'Connell, Louise O'Reilly, Lisa Chambers, really strong, capable, able women who've come in, and they've changed the way we've done our politics, and they've changed the perception of the Dáil and of Leinster House. And we're not there yet. I think we saw a huge increase in the number of women in the Dáil after the last election. Be very interested now coming up to the local elections to see how that reflects in terms of the number of female candidates, especially when you consider that we had the referendum on the Eighth Amendment last year. Obviously, that was a landslide, yes. What we saw afterwards were many women kind of feeling maybe a little bit politicised and looking for a party to go to, whether it be Labour or the Sock Dems. So whether we see that actually transfer through to the local elections will be really, really important. And I think it's something that we're keeping an eye on.
Was the boost in women, do you put it down to the quotas at the candidate level? Is that a practical change that, you know, there are lots of different views on it, but it did have an effect? It doesn't preclude who you vote for, but it does at least give more chances for have a choice of women.
Absolutely, and I'm open to correction on this, but I think after the gender quotas were brought in, we saw around a 40% increase in female representation in politics. And at the time when we discussed gender quotas, there was a lot of criticism. There were even women, and I will put myself in there too, who were very sceptical about it. And possibly the reason why was, I don't think any woman wants to be seen as the token woman or just there because you're a woman. That might have been some of the pushback, and that's certainly why I had reservations about it. But actually, in the fullness of time, what it's done is get women onto the ticket. And actually, it's given women confidence to be able to do it. And sometimes that's all that a woman needs, is to be able to have the confidence to know that you can go out there, put yourself forward, be scrutinised, and do the job just as well as any other man. And that's what the quotas did for us.
At a practical level, if you're a woman in the Dáil, so it's still a minority and it's improving, is it a lone? Do you get the impression that it can be a lonely job, that because there aren't as many allies there as you might otherwise have?
Sometimes. I think it's kind of, I wouldn't want to say yes, because I feel like that's kind of a very broad generalisation. But I will say, for example, on Tuesday mornings or Wednesday mornings, politicians will come out onto the plinth at the front of the Dáil, and they'll give what we call a doorstep, basically, where we ask them about the issues of the day. And you might see two male TDs coming out and a female TD. And the two male TDs will always talk first, and they're very sure of themselves. They know exactly what they want to say, and they can answer all the questions. And sometimes I see in some of the female TDs, they have to speak up a little bit more. Maybe they speak last. Maybe they're not quite so sure. Our own questions get asked to the journalists. They tend to go towards the male TDs. That's implicit. I don't think that's something that we really notice, but it's very, very subtle. So I do still think that there's a long way to go. And like I said before, it's this issue of confidence. So, but then in terms of inside parties, the structures within, I know that majority, all of, I would say, of the female TDs are pretty well supported by their male counterparts. We've seen examples in the past. I remember of one TD being called Little Miss Piggy, of Joan Burton when it was remarked that she should be reined in. That kind of language too seems by and large to have gone away. Or even the night in the Dáil where we had a female TD being pulled onto a male TD's lap. That wouldn't happen now. So yeah, we have seen a change. We are seeing a change. It's positive.
Okay. And is it still a family unfriendly place? Does it militate against, I suppose, parents of either gender taking up leadership roles? What more can change, do you think?
I think there is a long way to go in terms of family friendly hours. There was some measures taken in Leinster House to change the way the sittings were carried out, basically, so that on a Tuesday you'd start later, so that the voting would happen earlier. And this would be to help, like you said, both women and men. But still, we have kind of, for example, tonight, the day that's in it now, Simon Harris will be up late taking questions and answers on the National Children's Hospital. That's going to sit for 80 minutes. That's still untenable. If you have a child and you've got childcare, how are you supposed to get out on time? And, you know, I'm not to be reverse sexist about it, but the burden does generally fall on women a lot of the time to organise that or be the person who arranges it or the fallback, etc. So those hours, there was an effort made. More of an effort needs to be made. They're still not friendly towards families. And I can see that it probably will put a lot of women off actually wanting to go into politics if it meant your family life suffering and that guilt too.
Caoimhe, around the world, it's a curious thing in terms of female representation in parliaments. You often see in what could be described as quite traditional societies, very high representation of women, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and some countries. How do you explain that kind of anomaly?
Well, the first thing I would say is that you don't see it very often. There's a couple of standout exceptions, to be honest, Rwanda and very recently Ethiopia. But I think a point that Jen makes is really important. It's about not just about presence. Now, presence is critical. It's the first step, but it's also about influence once you have a seat. So, you know, you take a country like Rwanda, where 55% of the women are parliamentarians, but it's essentially a very patriarchal, male-dominated society, a very presidential form of governance and a very patriarchal kind of culture. So it's fantastic that those women are dominant in parliament, but that doesn't mean that they have 55% of the influence.
And in Trocar's work then, do ye have to work almost behind the scenes for almost micro leadership for women? You know what I mean? So women, financial independence at a micro level. So forget about your, it doesn't matter whether the Minister for Finance is a woman or not. It's whether the small farmer can borrow 10 shilling or 10 pounds or whatever the currency is in order to buy seeds. Is that where ye operate in order to create small nodes of leadership?
Well, we operate at all levels, to be completely honest. Like, what's fundamentally important to a woman is that, you know, when you think of what the first line of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. So if you believe that everybody is born free and equal in dignity and rights, well then, what's the difference between a man and a woman? Every woman should be given the opportunity to use her voice and her innate capability to participate in decisions affecting her life and the life of her family and her community. So the confidence that Jen speaks about in Ireland is equally, if not more important, in societies that are deeply traditional and where there are so many social norms going against a woman voicing her opinion or coming out even within her family unit and beyond the family unit and saying, look, from my perspective, this would be a better way of doing things, and standing up and taking a leadership role. So it's extremely important that we work at that level with women to achieve tangible changes at the community level. But equally, when you think about politics, like, what is politics? Essentially, it's the system and the art whereby, you know, the rules of society are formed and the resources within society are allocated. So if you don't have, and Rwanda really is exceptional, let's just be clear, most governments in Africa and many other countries, including Ireland, have a minority of women in parliament. So if you don't have women participating equally with equal share of voice as well as equal seats in parliament, then rules will be made which can ignore issues that affect women and issues that women care about or perhaps are more conscious of than men. So many countries around the world these days still have laws which preclude women from having ownership over land or other assets, or even from not being seen as the property of a male member of family. And that derives directly from male control over the political system. So it's absolutely essential that we increase the participation of women in decision making at all levels, be it at the family and community level, but also at the higher levels.
Lindsay, in terms of leadership styles, as a captain, did you find there's a fundamental difference between the leadership style of a woman captain or a male captain, or is it just all about the sport?
I suppose it depends on the person that's involved in that role. Like, for me, like, everyone has different leadership styles and come across differently. But for me, when I was captain, I was all about kind of leading by example. And I, like, with my performance, how I played it, I'd, like, put in a hard shift. I'd expect girls to kind of do the same. And but that's in society. Everyone has different leadership styles and qualities. And I suppose for me, that's how I probably best got my leadership across, was, like I said, through example. But I know even now with Mick would be very open kind of leadership. He likes getting everyone involved, getting everyone's opinion. Even with the Dublin team now, we'd have a leadership group. So if anyone has any issues with the girls throughout the team, you know, you can go to the leadership group. So it's more, instead of one individual taking ownership of leadership, it's more of a group decision and everyone working together, which I think it's a fantastic setup to have within a team.
Jennifer, it sounds like, you know, in sport, it's not a gender-specific leadership style, but have you noticed in your time covering politics that there is a woman's way of leading and a man's way of leading?
I kind of thought, when you were asking that question of Lindsay, well, I wonder what the story is in politics. And actually, when I was thinking about it, not really. I take, for example, two examples. Mary Lou McDonald's the leader of Sinn Féin. Micheál Martin's the leader of Fianna Fáil. If you look at their two leadership styles, Mary Lou McDonald could be described as, she gives it both barrels. She could definitely be described as forthright. She's not afraid to get stuck in. And in terms of her own party, she wouldn't, you know, she wouldn't take any messing, let's put it that way. And Micheál Martin is the exact same. He's very forthright. He's definitely not afraid to get stuck into the government. And they actually, in a way, they're quite similar. So I think maybe as well to point out, Marilyn MacDonald might be quite different from a lot of female leaders. Maybe in politics, especially, it's hard to compare because we only have the, obviously, it's usually male kind of dominated in terms of leadership. But in terms of your question, I think that we do see kind of the same characteristics, and I don't know whether that's because it's politics and that's the way you have to be, or whether that's just because politics is evolving.
Okay. But there is that kind of saying that somehow we'd have less wars if there were more women leaders. Do we believe that women would be different, Caoimhe, if there was more women prime ministers around the table in leadership roles? Or does, as Jennifer is talking about, does the job actually change the person and the style?
Okay, well, I guess this is a case where the world hasn't had an opportunity to test the hypothesis in the other direction.
Not yet.
Because we haven't had enough women in leadership positions to really understand to what degree are women adapting their way of being to a man's world, a very masculine form of politics and governance. I fundamentally believe that we're socialized in certain ways, that we're not born with a certain style. You know, we are informed by social norms and expectations around what's the behaviour that's appropriate for a woman. So the examples of the three politicians standing on the plinth don't surprise me in the least, you know, because girls and women are socialised to be, you know, kind of a little bit more, you know, kind of subtle or a little bit gentler. And boys are socialised, just say your piece, get it out there.
Absolutely.
So I think it's about masculinity. So I'm delighted to hear, to have this conversation and to hear that actually those norms are breaking down, like the concepts of masculinity and femininity, which we have inherited and they're traditional in Ireland, are still very strong. They still ascribe the role that you can play, but they're being broken down. We can see that and feel that. I think there's a great exercise that you can do, and I really encourage anyone to do it. Take a piece of paper, write down all of the traits that you think inherently are male on the piece of paper and draw a box around it, if you're a man. If you're a woman, do the same. All of the traits that go with being a female. Draw a box around it and then look at it and then go, do I want to be in that box? Guaranteed you'll have written down things like nurturing, caring, supportive if you're a woman. And if you're a man, it'll be like responsibility, strong, tough. None of us need to live within those boxes. And I think that's what this conversation shows, is we're moving beyond that. But it's part of our responsibility to help others do that too.
In terms of, recognition for the work that gets done, do you find that still there is respect for, you know, it's kind of the way there's a bias in the world for respect for different types of work and different types of leadership, so that, you know, strong, forceful, do-it leadership is given more credence, whereas more collegiate, consultative is seen as weak or takes too long to implement?
I would think so. I'd be interested in what Jen and Lindsay think, but I would think so. Like, if you think again about behaviour at senior management level, at board level, now I'm extremely fortunate in that I work in an organisation that is very strongly encouraging of gender equality. But nonetheless, I see behaviours regularly which do reward that kind of like decisive, you know, somewhat aggressive testosterone-fueled decision taking, you know. And we've seen the downsides of that, like in the economic crash. Why do corporations fail? It's because they were taking risks which were not adequately thought through, and they weren't giving enough sensitivity to who's going to be affected by this. And I think, again, because we've been socialised to think like this, women would be more inclined to think, no, hold on, what are all the implications of this? It's not that men don't, but I think there are innate tendencies towards rewarding a man's sort of let's go get the job done sort of power, versus what a woman might bring into the room, which might be more like, let's consider this from a number of angles and what are the opportunities and what are the impacts.
I totally agree with everything you said there. And I think a really interesting example that you give in terms of the economic crash, there were a lot of risks taken and there was a certain bullishness about decisions that were made. And many commentators have pointed out how interesting it would have been if we had more females in leadership positions, not only in politics, but in banking and across society at the time. And I mean, obviously, like you said, we haven't had the chance to test any of these hypotheses, maybe in the future, hopefully in the future.
For all of you, what do you think, and I'll start with you, Lindsay, could be done to get more women involved, say, from the point of view of the GAA, some more women referees, trainers, managers, county board officials. They're all part of the same continuum. What do you think? Is it a matter of time? Are there specific steps that could be taken to improve representation?
Well, like Jen said, it is difficult for women, especially in football. Like, I kind of get asked the question, would you go into management like down the line? And I'm like, well, I don't know, because I don't know what my personal circumstances at the time will be. Do you know, obviously, I'd love to in theory, but if I have a family and, you know, a woman goes off and, like, even for women playing football, like, a male has a much longer career than a female, because I even know myself, I'm 29 now, and the next couple of years you're thinking about starting a family and stuff. And do you know, you can't still play in a pitch. Like, well, you're off having a baby, a man can still keep playing football. So there are the different scenarios where it just sometimes isn't feasible for a woman to get into management. Then, like you said, Jen, with childcare and stuff, a woman kind of thinks a lot different to a man, like different responsibilities to look after the home. So they are the things that I suppose do make it a lot difficult for women to get involved in management. But I've seen the past couple of years with Mick, it's been brilliant. Like, we've had former players come back on the management team now, obviously not as a manager but as coaches, and they've been fantastic asset to have. But again, like, even last year, Elaine Kelly, she's gone and had a baby now, so she's had to step away. Now hopefully in a few months down the line we might get her back in some form or capacity. But I do think it is changing from the LGFA in encouraging kind of women, female referees. Like, it is changing and we are getting more and more people involved. But unfortunately, as an athlete, it is a little bit harder, I suppose, being a female, to stay involved for longer.
It sounds like the what you talk about there is something that could transcend all, you know, C-level jobs in many companies. But it feels like it should be perfectly fine to, you know, play, stop, go away for a while, come back. Whereas there's often an emphasis on continuity, isn't there? Like, you have to be in there all the way through. Whereas the idea of taking a break in the GAA is relatively new. You know, players go off to Australia for a year and suddenly somebody's taken their place. And the idea of taking a break to live your life is still quite new in the GAA, isn't it? And it needs to be inculcated more.
Yeah, well, I definitely see now there's a lot. Well, for me, when I was finished college, I went off in a J1. I took a year out and I went travelling and I came back. But so there's only a certain time frame when you can do that, because the longer you leave it and the longer you're out for it, the harder it is to get back into the fold. The game is changing so much. There's much more of an emphasis on strength and conditioning. The physicality is getting a bit stronger and stuff. So the longer you're out, it is much harder to get back into it. But it is, I think women do need to get a, just, I suppose any kind of athlete needs to get away for a while and enjoy their life as well, and then hopefully come back and play again.
So from a training and a refereeing point of view, say heading off at 30 or whatever age, coming back at whatever period of time you want, should be fine in the training context. You shouldn't have had to be serving your time all the way through.
Well, I know if I was to go off now for a year or two, I wouldn't get back into the fold. I don't think I'd be physically capable of. Like, I've been playing senior since I've been 15, so I've had a long time, and that's a lot of demands on your body physically to be playing that long. But like, I know I was considering kind of retiring this or last year, and again, it's just because I've put so much into the sport over the years. You do miss out on stuff as well at home, and, you know, different people's priorities and life, I suppose, in general. But like I said, the benefits I have from sport have definitely outweighed the negatives, and I'm very lucky to be in that position. But I'm very fortunate again as well that, you know, personal circumstances changed. I was able to give it another year, and it's just fantastic to kind of still be involved.
And Jennifer, as we've spoken briefly about improving the progression in politics, in the media, what would you see as helping women get to leadership roles in the media? Because I presume we're still not in a great place in terms of editors of main news outlets and media outlets, are we? And indeed ownership.
There have been precious few female editors of newspapers. When I started out in the Sunday Tribune, the editor was female, Noreen Haggerty, and she was excellent. She was amazing, and she was great to younger journalists coming in. Then she went off to other ventures, I think in Lonely Planet. And I think if you look across the spectrum now, we don't have any female editors except for Susan Daly of The Journal, who also does an excellent job. So I think that there, it's still incredibly male dominated at the upper echelons of media. And on a personal level, the reason why I think that is partially is because of issues that, you know, Lindsay talked about family. It's about once you take a break, you're taking a break from your career. And when you come back, things aren't the same. When you come back, you might have missed major events in news. You might have missed the opportunity to get a key promotion once or twice up the line. And that is a real problem in terms of encouraging women or improving that situation. To be totally honest with you, I actually don't know. I've thought about this a lot, and I think a huge part of it for women in journalism is the same as it is for women in politics, and that's confidence. It's having the ability to say, well, okay, of course I'm able to do that job. He's able to do that job. Why do I always think I'm not able to do this? Even when over, like when I was starting out over the first few years, my male counterparts would be asked to go on radio or on television, and they'd do it and they'd talk about their stories and no problem. Whereas I would be having a near panic attack at the thought of it. You know, I'd be doing breathing techniques, and it's a very strange position to find yourself in when you have male colleagues looking at you and kind of saying, why do you feel like that? I don't feel like that. Nobody else feels like that. So it's the same for women in politics as it is in media, as it is in sports and across the spectrum, I'd say, in that a pure lack of confidence, because you have to remember that we're coming from a position in society whereby we were always second best. We're coming from a position in society where men were in charge of, you know, whether it be church, whether it be politics, whether it be business. So we don't have that inherent confidence that comes with hundreds and hundreds of years of being in charge. And we really need to work on that. So we need to support each other. And I don't know whether it'd be worth having, I know this sounds kind of glib, but like workshops or, I don't know, to set up. I mean, women in election do great work, but there definitely needs to be some sort of national cohesive effort to basically convince women that we can do it. We can do it just as well as men. And sometimes we can do it better.
Caoimhe, when you're operating in different worlds, you know, in terms of income levels, this is a wealthy country. You operate in the poorest of countries. What's it like comparing the challenges for women, which are can be so elemental in one place, and then obviously recognizing the challenges that women have here? Do you have to operate on both levels and say we need victories at a certain level here, but also, listen, there's some really basic things need to be done?
Yeah, but I mean, it all starts with the same fundamental understanding. Like I find that it is really helpful to be able to point to Ireland's trajectory of change, even going back over 100 years. The fact that, you know, it was an Irish woman who was the first parliamentarian in Western Europe, the first cabinet minister in Western Europe, you know, and then, you know, Ireland was such a traditional society until not terribly long ago. Like, I would tell these stories to women and girls that I meet in countries that we work in where they're really struggling with deeply, deeply difficult situations. I guess, going back to your question, there are stark differences between a country like Ireland and the countries we work in, but actually our history is not that far apart. So I spent 3 years in Malawi until quite recently. And to be honest, you know, if I was to go back 100 years in Ireland, I would say I'd find very, very similar issues. Some would be further ahead in Malawi. I'll give you a concrete example of the things that, you know, might not occur to you but can make a massive difference. And you can relate this to Ireland and our current situation as well. When I arrived in Malawi, we had teams of field workers out in the rural areas, and they're agricultural workers. So they're almost all men. But the universities and third level colleges were producing lots of, you know, capable young women who were getting much greater levels of educational attainment, as women in Ireland do, by the way. So I was like, why do we have this problem recruiting women? Sat down and looked at the job descriptions at the ads, and I was like, no, it says on the bottom we're an equal opportunities employer. What's going wrong? Look more closely. Must be able to ride a motorbike. How many young women in rural Malawi are going to be able to ride a motorbike? We changed it to must be willing to learn to ride a motorbike. Instant change. The teams are now 100% gender balanced, if not a little bit in the other direction. So it's about thinking outside the box and thinking about how do you make it more comfortable for a woman to say, you know what, I can do that. Maybe I can't ride a motorbike now, but I'm capable of learning. And you can apply that here as well.
So women need to spoof as well as the men.
No, women need to be encouraged. No, but the real serious point is that organisations and people who are in a position where they might be hiring women need to think, OK, is there anything here that would deter a woman who has the capacity to do this job from coming and applying for it? And then also the inherent bias. I'm sorry, but Ireland is rife with it, an inherent bias against girls and women advancing in their careers or doing well. So we need to address it. People don't see it. They don't understand it in themselves. So first of all, take away the veil so that we can understand, look, I have an inherent bias, so do you.
What is the manifestation of that inherent bias?
I think it's things like, you know, again, the journalists who automatically default to the man. So I have walked into a room where there are men and women circulating around, and a man, you know, you stop and you go, oh, hello, and how are you? And my name is Caoimhe de Barr from Throcra. And they go, oh, and look over your head towards somebody more important. So towards some man who's more important than you are. These things happen all the time. And I think the issue is, partly, men don't see it. It's so normalised.
Okay. That happens to me at comedy gatherings where just looking at a better comedian, but I think it's just, but that's just me. Caoimhe, you alluded to Constance Markovitch, first ever parliamentarian in Europe. For our panel, who is a woman that you look up to, an Irish woman that you look up to, past or present, and aspire to or want to emulate?
Can I pick more than one?
Absolutely.
I think in terms of politics, probably people like Kate O'Connell, they speak their mind. Louise Riley from Sinn Féin, she's brilliant. She's a great parliamentarian. And Lisa Chambers, who would be one of the younger women who went into the Dáil and who has absolutely smashed in terms of being the Brexit spokeswoman. Now, that's from a personal perspective. Obviously, I'm not biased in favour of any of those parties. I just need to say.
Lindsay?
Yeah, well, I suppose from a sporting perspective, obviously when I was younger, Sonia Sullivan would have been one of the top female athletes that I would have looked up to. But now I think the likes of Katie Taylor is just unbelievable. Like, she was the one that fought to get the boxing into the Olympics and succeeded in that. And she's just gone from strength to strength now, even in her professional career. And I think she's just an absolute role model, like in and out of the ring. And even her documentary a few weeks ago was fantastic. I think so many kind of younger girls are getting into boxing now just as a result of her. Like, so, but even across Ireland, there's so many female athletes. Like, you have the women's rugby team, the hockey team with their success stories. Like, it's just a very exciting time in female sport. It just really has gone from strength to strength.
For the likes of Katie Taylor, she fought to get boxing into the Olympics, fought to get her own gym. What is it that she does that more people should do and emulate, do you think?
Well, I think as a female athlete, belief in herself, belief that she could be better, that she strove to be better. And I think that's the problem with women across Ireland. We just don't have enough belief in ourselves. So even, I suppose, if you're going into, a female goes into an interview, I know for myself, for being a firefighter, we don't back ourselves. We don't go enough as to, you know, support ourselves and put out our positive attributes, what we can bring to the job. Where a male is probably so much more inclined to say, I'll do X, Y and Z for you. Where a woman, we're a bit more, it's probably insecure in our own abilities. I think with Katie, I think it was just total belief in herself and she fought for what she knew she could do. And it's fantastic to see her success as a result of that, just self-belief and fighting for what she wanted.
Okay, as we approach International Women's Day, how will you be marking it and how do you think it should be marked? Caoimhe, how will you mark it and what else could happen?
Well, in Throcra, we'll certainly be marking it very strongly because gender equality and work for gender equality is a huge part of what we do. So we'll be celebrating the successes we've seen worldwide around women, you know, putting themselves forward, for example, for political leadership. And I think, you know, hopefully around Ireland, people will be celebrating in different ways, celebrating the advances that we have made and also being grateful. I'm very grateful to the generations of women that went before us that have enabled us to have this kind of conversation, even just this open conversation around gender equality in Ireland now.
Jennifer?
I think I will probably try and write a mahoosive piece about women who are coming up in politics in the local elections. There are some amazing female candidates coming up. I really mean it. They're so, so impressive. And then probably after doing that, I might have a really big glass of Pinot Grigio.
Lindsay?
Well, in Scaries, they're actually after doing a thing this year where you could, across the community, you could nominate a female who has inspired you or has done well in her own personal life. And there's been, I think, up to 60 women have been voted across different walks of life. And they're having then a big get together. And I'm not sure what's involving on the night. But I just think that's fantastic to kind of get a group of females who have inspired other people to come together and enjoy that success, I suppose.
Sounds like it's a personification of International Women's Day perfectly. That sounds great. Yeah. Okay, that's all we have time for today. My thanks to Jennifer, Lindsay and Caoimhe for joining us. I will be back next month for another episode of The World, etc.